It's time for Bible reading. I'll be reading in Dinka, in our reading for today, Job 19, parts of that reading. Kwendana kolobo kwen, chato leke Job, thiar kudungan, abajal gol chokero, abudin, thiro kudungan, abo kwen. Delje, kigring je, kigring, achig nwed yom koth. E del nyar en adong yaka pyo kok na yan maskia yaka pyo kok na yan ne biak kin yali ki kin tao ne yagwo e ngul loy weka en kor kor ayadan kin man luy ni ali je yan wer ka ngur ka wo lang we ade jod ade jodek ran wukulwele garpin awaragi kabro kabrot muk ade jo tweng ukur ko na galam we kabto de ananda angej ade ran biyan werbe angej non piren kumyak lekang dar do abukoy na pinum eten ku konya na chakto uchu gob di liu kanyej nan ban ngod kaya yen ni al kabini al ting aba ting yen gob dia ni nyin kia ku achi bi aran le de tada yen ku yen edak ku yen edak na tie tie dan e kam na ya kalwel ana rong buk job kur jam tar a chat ke yen ka we gi kon jakar yoj na ba taw na biag yi go ya got kombe yene kana yena ba we joni on de yen kichol gier de long
now we'll read in English and Job chapter 19 is printed inside your information sheet Job chapter 19 beginning at verse 1 Job answered and said, How long will you torment me and break me in pieces with words? These 10 times you have cast reproach upon me. Are you not ashamed to wrong me? And even if it be true that I have erred, my error remains with myself. If indeed you magnify yourselves against me and make my disgrace an argument against me, know then that God has put me in the wrong and closed his net about me. Behold, I cry out, violence, but I am not answered. I call for help, but there is no justice. He has walled up my way so that I cannot pass, and he has set darkness upon my paths. He has stripped from me my glory and taken the crown from my head. He breaks me down on every side, and I am gone. And my hope he has pulled up like a tree. He has kindled his wrath against me and counts me as his adversary. His troops come on together. They have cast up their siege ramp against me and encamp around my tent. He has put my brothers far from me, and those who knew me are wholly estranged from me. My relatives have failed me. My close friends have forgotten me. The guests in my house and my maidservants count me as a stranger. I have become a foreigner in their eyes. I call to my servant, but he gives me no answer. I must plead with him with my mouth for mercy. My breath is strange to my wife, and I am a stench to the children of my own mother. Even young children despise me. When I rise, they talk against me. All my intimate friends abhor me. Those whom I loved are turned against me. My bones stick to my skin and to my flesh, and I have escaped by the skin of my teeth. Have mercy on me. Have mercy on me, O you, my friends. For the hand of God has touched me. Why do you, like God, pursue me? Why are you not satisfied with my flesh? Oh, that my words were written. Oh, that they were inscribed in a book. Oh, that with an iron pen and lead they were engraved on rock forever. For I know that my Redeemer lives. And at the last he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been thus destroyed, yet in my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself, and my eyes shall behold and not another. My heart faints within me. If you say how we will pursue him, and the root of the matter is found in him, be afraid of the sword. For wrath brings the punishment of the sword, and you may know there is a judgment. Dark words from Job for an Easter morning. Easter is fantastic to celebrate, isn't it? Jesus raised, the price for sins paid for all time, death defeated. The first dawn of the new creation that the old prophets looked forward to. Big, big things going on that we celebrate at Easter. Starting in history, early in the morning at Passover time, in Palestine, in the first century, with Jesus' resurrection. And here is one of those big, big things going on at Easter. The answer to one of the biggest, the most troubling problems that people have in any age of the world. And the answer is right here in Easter. Job felt the weight of this particular problem. His friends felt the weight of this problem. Buddha felt the weight of it and used it to start a whole philosophy. Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens felt the weight of this problem and used it as one of their planks to prove that God cannot possibly be there. And lots of our friends and our relatives feel it and take it down the same track as Dawkins and Hitchens. Last November, when the Paris attacks happened, the Archbishop of Canterbury felt the weight of this and made the huge mistake of putting it into a soundbite before he could explain himself. And if we haven't felt the weight of this problem, either we have understood our Bibles so well that we missed that there was a problem, or else we just don't feel things. Problem is this. The universe is a moral vacuum, and we don't want it to be. I mean, the universe is a place where good and bad and right and wrong really do not seem to count for anything. We don't want it to be that way because we feel that there should be justice in the universe. We feel like good things should be rewards. And bad things should be punishments. We feel like God should make it so that good people do well and nice things happen to them. And bad people should do badly and they should fail in their evil plans and bad things should happen to them. They're the ones who should get sick and they're the ones who ought to die young. Now, when I say it like that, I think we spot it at once as really superstitious preschool theology. But most religions and superstitions in the world feel some version of that. But without some way of dealing with good and dealing with bad, we have a bigger problem. Where's the justice? Where is God? How can God be good when people do bad things and they just keep getting away with it? The universe is a moral vacuum. So poor old Justin Welby, the Archbishop of Canterbury, sees what happens in Paris and he wants to know. Can God even be there if things like this happen? And terrorism, like what happened in Paris, terrorism throws this into sharp relief because terrorism is so random. Those people in Brussels on Tuesday, they were just regular people taking trains and planes. They could have been any of us. When Jenny and I were travelling through India the other year, there was news on the local news in India. There was news of a bomb blast or an attempted bomb blast pretty much every second day. Railway stations, post offices, public places. It was most disturbing when something like that would happen in a place where we had been just a couple of days before. And I was filled with a sense of things that are tough enough for people in this country already. How do you think you're going to make it better by blowing things up? You know, really. And with that sort of thing, who gets hurt is so random. The people planting the bomb don't know who's going to die. They don't know who's going to be injured. How is there any justice in the universe? We went down to Nagapattinam in the south of India and visited people who'd been in the Boxing Day tsunami in 2004. These were people who lost homes, they lost families. Is there any hint of justice in that? You know people in South Sudan and people from South Sudan. The rebel soldiers come through the village and they wreck things and they kidnap teenagers. Then the government soldiers come through and chase the rebels out and wreck things and kidnap teenagers. There's no justice in any of that. Or the personal and private one, when the doctor gets your test results back and calls you in for a consultation. And there's no right or wrong about it. So, Dawkins and Hitchens say the universe is a moral vacuum, and that's what you'd expect. And Buddha says the universe is a moral vacuum. So, remove yourself from desire and learn to cope with it. And Justin Welby, the Archbishop, well, he should have said, attacks in Paris, that's exactly what my Bible leads me to expect would happen. The world is a Romans chapter 1 world where human beings are foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. This world is a world fit for sinners. This world is a world entirely suited to people who leave God out of the picture. Paris attacks? What did you expect to happen? But if you're upset about what happens, there is something else you ought to see. That's what the Archbishop of Canterbury should have said. And the something else you ought to see is embedded in Easter. And the something else you ought to see is good news for all people everywhere. It is ecstatic news. And the road to the something else goes through this ancient book of Job. Now in Job, we are somewhere in the dim, dark centuries BC. With Job, we are outside ancient Israel. We're in some place called the land of Uz. And there is Job, and he's having a very bad day. Job is not an especially bad person. Chapter 1 says, that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. Job makes sacrifices for his sins, and so in the Old Testament way he deals with sins. And Job has a nice family, he has a nice home, he has a successful business, lots of money, and it all looks pretty good. Then it goes wrong. So in 1 verse 13, now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and there came a messenger to Job and said, the oxen were ploughing and the donkeys feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans fell on them and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, the fire of God fell from heaven and burned the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you. While he was yet speaking, there came another, and on it goes. Everything gone. Job's children gone. And then in chapter 2, Job's health goes too. You know, sometimes you get those doctors who look at Egyptian mummies and try to work out what they died from. You know, all the dreadful diseases that were around in Egyptian times and what version of the flu the pharaohs caught. And they've got a great one of those down at the Australian Museum at the moment with a mummy and all the CAT scans and x-rays and pathology samples and things, putting together all the dreadful things that this Egyptian lady died of. But we can't do that for poor Job. He gets hit with so many diseases at once that his symptoms are all over the place. In chapter 2, his body is covered with loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. In chapter 30, his bones ache so that he cannot sleep at night. He has other symptoms too, but not ones you want to think about on Easter Day. But look at our own passage, verse 17. His breath is foul. In verse 20, he's got the physique of a supermodel, all skin and bones. With all this going on, poor old Job needs a friend. And he has three. Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. And they really are true friends. And they try to comfort him. But here's where it goes wrong, and why the book of Job in the Old Testament is so long. Job's three friends are convinced that the universe, this universe, is a moral place. You know, they are the kind of characters who write self-help books on how the godly person will live a healthy and successful life. So what do they do to try to help Job when everything has gone wrong? Well, Eliphaz has a great line in chapter 4, verse 7. Remember, who that was innocent ever perished? Those who plough iniquity and sow trouble reap the same. So you do bad things, you'll get bad stuff. Chapter 5. Behold, blessed is the one whom God reproves, therefore despise not the discipline of the Almighty. That's a great line, isn't it? Job, all the bad things that are happening to you, that is God's discipline. He's punishing you because you've done something wrong. Bildad knows exactly who to blame. Job has lost all his children and now Job is desperately ill. So Bildad turns up and starts saying in chapter 8, if your children have sinned against him, that is, if your children have sinned against God, he has delivered them into the hand of their transgression. If you will seek God and plead with the Almighty for mercy, if you are pure and upright, surely he will rouse himself for you. See, if you're good, God will fix you up. And your children, Job, well, they got everything they deserved. I think though Zophar is best of all. Chapter 11. Know then that God exacts of you less than your guilt deserves. See, you're such a bad person, it really ought to be a lot worse for you than it is, Job. These are true friends, and they mean well, but dear me. Now, in the face of all this, poor old Job is completely stumped. What can he say? He knows that he hasn't done anything catastrophically wrong. He fears God and turns from evil. But he doesn't know how to argue with these people. You wouldn't. When you are in a hospital bed, when you're in intensive care and you're all tubed up, who wants to get in some argument about theology? But Job believes. Job believes that God rewards the good and punishes the evil here in this life. So he has no answer for his friends. All he can say is that he would like to have a few words with God himself. But he can't see that happening anytime soon. It can't happen here and now in this life. And as for anything beyond this life, Job doesn't look forward to anything beyond this life. After all, you get rewarded and punished with good things and bad things here and now. So in chapter 10, Job thinks that the rest of his life is not going to be much good, and he wants his life to hurry up and end. But all he can see coming afterwards in chapter 10 is, I go and I shall not return to the land of darkness and deep shadow, to the land of gloom and thick darkness, like deep shadow without any order, where light is as thick darkness. Then in chapter 19, where we have it in front of us, Job finally hits the roof. That's an idiom, isn't it? He gets really cross. He's had enough of the kind of comfort that comes with his friends. So he tells them straight in verse 2, how long will you torment me and break me in pieces with words? These 10 times you have cast reproach upon me. Are you not ashamed to wrong me? They just keep telling him it must be his fault. Yeah, they're not using those big flappy things on the sides of their heads. They will not listen. So Job bewails everything that has happened to him. Verse 6, he cries out, there is no justice from God. Verse 14, Job's relatives and friends have failed him. Verse 17, even his wife won't come near him because of the smell. Verse 19, even his best friends have turned against him. Verse 20, he hasn't got anyone or anything left in the world. He hasn't done anything wrong, but everyone thinks he must be guilty because bad things are happening. And you can imagine words being shouted out with tears when he says in verse 21, have mercy on me, O you my friends. Have mercy on me. Then, at the height of the emotional storm, in this moment of great passion, things change. You know how sometimes when something has been eating away at your mind for days, and then in a blinding, it's like a lightning flash, in one moment it all comes together and it makes sense in your head. You know, this is the bit down in verse 23. This is the bit when Job puts his hands on his head and he says, now, wait a minute. We have all been wrong. Oh, dear, it's not like we thought. I am not like that. God is not like that. The universe is not like that. We have been wrong all the time. And suddenly, everything makes sense. Look at the change. Verse 23. Oh, that my words were written. Well, he got that wish, didn't he? Oh, that with an iron pen and lead they were engraved on rock forever. Job wants what he says next to be carved in stone. Why? Because with all these diseases, he doesn't expect to live much longer. But what he has to say next is the important bit, the bit that makes it different. Verse 25, a complete surprise after everyone has deserted him. Verse 25, I know that my Redeemer lives, and at last he will stand upon the earth. Now, screw your eyes up and press your eyeballs and look at this verse again. In the Old Testament, if Job says he's got a Redeemer, he means he's got someone to look after him when things get really tough. But he's just told us that everyone has let him down and God must be out to get him. So who could possibly be his redeemer? It is not obvious. So he tells us in verse 26, "And after my skin has been thus destroyed, yet in my flesh I shall see God." Now he's not talking about being skinned alive here. He's talking about after he's died. He's dropped all of that business from chapter 10 of "I go and I shall not return to the land of darkness and deep shadow." Now he is talking about resurrection. How do we know? Verse 26. "In my flesh I shall see God." Verse 27. "Whom I shall see for myself, and my eyes behold," not another. This is the blinding flash. See, they've been saying, Job is suffering, so Job must have done wrong. Or there is no justice. But what if dying is not the end? What if dying is not even nearly the end? Bring in resurrection, and what happens? Job turns to his friends in verse 28, and full of new confidence, he tells them off. Verse 28, "If you say how we will pursue him, and the root of the matter is found in him, be afraid of the sword. For wrath brings the punishment of the sword, that you may know that there is a judgment." There is a judgment, and it's not here and now, but there is a judgment. There is something here. There is something here that is so good that even the bad bits of it are good. If there is judgment, there can be sense to good and bad. If there is judgment, then people don't get away with evil forever. It's not about getting good things and bad things here and now anymore. If there is resurrection, everything is different. Because if there is resurrection, there is eternity to think about. Or to put it another way, this life here and now is not the biggest thing in your life. If there is resurrection, then this world is just the sphere of life that is mucked up by human evil. This world is just the sphere of life in a dark place that has rejected God. No wonder it's a moral vacuum. There's no justice to what happens in this life. Good things happen, bad things happen. Sometimes you get to live in a palace, sometimes you get a chronic disease. It's not a question of punishment or reward. It's just that life is in a hard world outside of Eden. But resurrection, that's the big one. And in verse 25, Job lifts his gaze to eternity. There is resurrection. That is where he'll see God. That is where wrongs are righted. That is where there is judgment. Not here. And for Job, that puts his horrible, ghastly suffering into a totally different perspective. It's not a punishment from God. It's got nothing to do with right and wrong. It is life in a dark world. But there is resurrection. This world is a dark place, but it doesn't mean there's no justice. The Archbishop of Canterbury, or Richard Dawkins, or even Buddha, all in different ways, can open their eyes to a wider world. If there is resurrection, there can be justice. Right and wrong can mean something. If there is judgment, God takes right and wrong seriously. And Easter makes it even better. For Job, resurrection is a blinding flash, a moment of insight, a moment of aha that makes sense of everything. But he might be wrong about it. he's sort of worked it out. He could be wrong. For us, though, resurrection, it's a piece of our history. Jesus has been raised. In Roman Palestine, on that spring morning, the women came to his tomb and he was alive again. Resurrection is a piece of history. So Job got it right. And even more than that, what happened that first Easter is just the beginning. There's a marvellous bit in the New Testament in 1 Corinthians when Paul talks about Jesus' resurrection as being the first fruits. That he was raised and that him being raised is the guarantee of more to come. For us, like Job, that ought to put everything into a different perspective. Everything. Jesus' resurrection on Easter Day means resurrection is real. The moral vacuum that flummoxed Dawkins and Buddha and everyone else is not the end of the story. Like Job says in verse 28, there is a judgment. And even better than that, Job believed God was his Redeemer. I know that my Redeemer lives. What does the New Testament say? Titus chapter 2. Our great God and Saviour, Jesus Christ, who gave himself for us to redeem us from all lawlessness. With Jesus giving his own life to redeem us, we can be very sure he is our Redeemer. If verse 29 is true, I need a Redeemer. I've spent my life in this dark world. If I am the least compromised, I need a Redeemer. If the universe is not going to be a moral vacuum, I'm like Job. I need a Redeemer. If there is a judgment, I need a Redeemer. And the big thing at Easter is, that is Jesus. So with him and trusting him as Redeemer, we can look forward to resurrection with confidence. And if life here and now is rough, then resurrection is what we need to hear about. Not some daft notion like Bildad's that we've got to work out what God is punishing us for. This life, here and now, is where random bad things happen. There are bombings in Brussels. There are raids on villages in Sudan. This is life in a dark world. But this life in this world, the Bible compares this life to those wildflowers that come up in the desert when it rains that only last for a couple of days. Eternity is what really counts. If there is resurrection, then there can be justice. Random suffering in this world is not the last word. And the good news of Easter is there is resurrection. Job imagined it. Jesus' resurrection proves it and opens the way there. Job, in his blinding flash, says, I know that my Redeemer lives. Jesus' resurrection says in great big letters, my Redeemer lives. And sticking our heads out of this little dark world to take a peek at resurrection, Paul says in Romans, I consider the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us. We ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit groan inwardly as we eagerly await adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. For in this hope we are saved. Job imagined it. Jesus begins it. And from Jesus onward, what do we look forward to? Much more than Job ever knew. We get the first glimpse of the new creation with Jesus' resurrection. But after that, the Bible begins to unfold more and more of what we look forward to. Let me finish with a couple of verses of what we look forward to from the book of Revelation. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, Behold, the dwelling of God is with men. He will dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself will be with them. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain any more, for the former things have passed away. Easter points the way there.